Mama's left eyebrow briefly broke formation. A boy? This morning, I saw him from the window when Mary moved me to my chair. He was standing behind a rhododendron bush, speaking with Davies, a naughty-looking boy with shaggy red hair. Mama pressed a hand against the pale skin beneath her neck, exhaled slowly and steadily so that Rose's interest was further piqued. That was no boy you saw, Rose. Mama? That was your cousin, Eliza. Rose's eyes widened. This was unexpected, principally because it couldn't be so. Mama had no brothers or sisters, and with Grandmama's passing, Mama, Papa, and Rose were the only Mountrachets left. I have no such cousin. Mama straightened, spoke unusually swiftly. Unfortunately, you do. Her name is Eliza, and she has come to live at Blackhurst.
For how long?
Indefinitely, I fear.
But Mama!
Rose felt more light-headed than ever. How could such a tatty urchin be her cousin?
Her hair, her manner, her clothes were all wet, and she dirty and wind-blown.
Rose shuddered.
There were leaves all over her person.
Mama lifted a finger to her lips. She turned to face the window, and the dark curl at the nape of her neck shivered. She had nowhere else to go. Father and I agreed to take her in. An act of Christian charity she'll never appreciate, let alone deserve, but one must always be seen to do the right thing.
But, Mama, what is she to do here?
Cause us great vexation, I've little doubt. But we could hardly turn her away. Failure to act would have looked dreadful. Thus must we turn necessity to virtue. Her words had the sound of sentiments being forced through a sieve. She seemed to sense their emptiness herself, and said nothing further.
Mama?
Rose poked cautiously at her mother's silence.
You asked what she is to do here.
Mama turned to face Rose, and a new edge entered her voice.
I am giving her to you.
Giving her to me?
As a project of sorts. She will be your protégé. When you are well enough, you will be responsible for teaching her how to behave.
She's little better than a savage, not one whit of grace or charm. An orphan who's had little, if any, guidance as to living in polite society. Mama exhaled. Of course, I have no illusions, and don't expect you to work miracles.
Yes, Mama.
You can only imagine, child of mine, the influences to which this orphan has been exposed. She has been living in London amongst such dreadful decadence and sin. And then Rose knew just who this girl must be. Eliza was the child of Papa's sister, the mysterious Georgiana, whose portrait Mama had banished to the attic, of whom nobody dared speak. Nobody, that is, except Grandmama. In the old woman's final months, when she had returned like a wounded bear to Blackhurst and retired to the turret room to do her dying, she drifted in and out of wakefulness, speaking in fits and starts about a pair of children called Linus and Georgiana. Rose knew Linus was her father. Thus, she gathered, Georgiana must be his sister, the one who had disappeared before Rose was born. It was a summery morning, and Rose was resting in the armchair by the turret window, a warm sea breeze tickling the back of her neck. Rose liked to sit by Grandmama, to study her as she slept, each breath possibly her last, and had been watching curiously as beads of sweat glazed the old woman's forehead. Suddenly Grandmama's eyes blinked open. They were wide and pale, bleached by a lifetime of bitterness. She stared at Rose a moment, but her gaze remained untouched by recognition and slid sideways. Transfixed, or so it seemed, by the gentle billowing of the summer curtains. Rose's first instinct was to ring for Mama. It had been hours since Grandmama last awoke, but just as she reached for the bell, the old woman heaved a sigh. A long, wearied sigh, so thoroughly deflating that thin skin sagged into hollows between her bones. Then, out of nowhere, a wizened hand clutched Rose's wrist. "Such a beautiful girl," she said, so quietly that Rose had to lean close to hear the words that were spoken next. "Too beautiful. A curse. Had all the young men's heads turning." He couldn't help himself. Followed her everywhere. Thought we didn't know. She ran away and didn't come back. Not a word from my Georgiana. Now, Rose Mountrachet was a good girl who knew the rules. How could she be anything other? Her entire life, confined to her sickbed, she'd been captive to her mother's episodic lecture on the rules and nature of good society. Rose knew all too well that a lady must never wear pearls or diamonds in the morning, must never cut someone socially, must never, under any circumstances, call on a gentleman alone. But most importantly of all, Rose knew that scandal was to be avoided at all costs, that it was an evil whose very hint could smite a lady where she stood. Smite, at least, her good name. And yet this mention of her errant aunt, the tantalizing whiff of a family scandal, did no such thing to Rose. On the contrary, it sent a wicked thrill racing down her spine. For the first time in years, she felt her fingertips tingle with excitement. She leaned closer still, willing Grandmama to continue, eager to follow the flow of conversation as it swirled into dark, uncharted waters. "Who, Grandmama?" prodded Rose. "Who was it followed her? Who did she run away with?" But Grandmama didn't answer. Whatever the scenarios that played across her mind, they refused manipulation. Rose persisted, but to no avail. And in the end, she had to be content with turning the questions over and over in her mind, the name of her aunt becoming for her a symbol of dark and testing times, of all that was unfair and wicked in the world. "Rose?" Mama's brows were knitted into a slight frown, one she tried to conceal, but which Rose had become practiced at recognizing. "Are you saying something, child? You were whispering." She reached out a hand to gauge Rose's temperature. "I'm all right, Mama, just a little distracted by my thoughts."
"You seem flushed."
Rose pressed her own hand against her forehead. Was she flushed? She couldn't tell.
"I shall send Dr. Matthews up again before he leaves," said Mama. "I'd sooner be careful than sorry."
Rose closed her eyes. Another visit from Dr. Matthews, two in the one afternoon. It was beyond her capacity to bear.
"You're too weak today to greet our new project," said Mama. "I'll speak with the doctor, and if he deems it suitable, you may meet Eliza tomorrow." Eliza! Imagine bestowing a Mountrachet family name on the daughter of a sailor.
A sailor? This was new. Rose's eyes snapped open.
Mama?
Mama grew flushed herself then. She'd said more than she intended, an unusual slip in her armor of propriety.
"Your cousin's father was a sailor. We do not speak of him."
"My uncle was a sailor?"
Mama gasped, and her thin hand leapt to her mouth. "He was not your uncle, Rose. He was nothing to you or me. He was no more married to your Aunt Georgiana than I was."
"But Mama!" It was more scandalous than Rose had ever been able to invent for herself. "Whatever can you mean?"
Mama's voice was low. "Eliza may be your cousin, Rose, and we have little choice but to have her in this house. But she's low-born, make no mistake of that. She is fortunate indeed that her mother's death has brought her back to Blackhurst, after all the shame this family suffered at the hands of her mother. She shook her head. It nearly killed your father when she left. I can't bear to think what might have happened had I not been here to see him through the scandal. She looked directly at Rose. Her voice contained the slightest tremble. A family can bear only so much shame before its good name is irreparably tarnished. That is why it's so important that you and I live spotlessly. Your cousin Eliza will present a challenge. Of that I have little doubt. She will never be one of us, but through our best efforts we will at least elevate her from the London gutter. Rose pretended absorption in the ruffled sleeve of her nightdress. Can a girl of low birth never be taught to pass herself off as a lady, Mama? No, my child. Not even if she were taken in by a noble family? Rose glanced at Mama from beneath her eyelashes. Married a gentleman, perhaps? Mama turned sharp eyes upon Rose and hesitated before speaking, slowly, carefully. It is possible, of course, that a rare girl of humble but proper beginnings, who works ceaselessly to improve herself, may effect an elevation. She drew a quick breath designed to settle her composure. But not, I fear, in the case of your cousin. We must lower our expectations, Rose.
Of course, Mama.
The real reason for her mother's discomfort sat between them, though Mama, if she'd suspected Rose knew, would have been mortified. It was another family secret that Rose had managed to glean from her dying grandmother. A secret that explained so much. The animosity between the two matriarchs, and even more than that, Mama's obsession with manners. Her devotion to the rules of society. Her commitment to presenting always as a paragon of propriety. Lady Adeline Mountrachet may have attempted to banish all mention of the truth long ago. Most who knew it had been terrified into wiping it from their memories, and those who hadn't were too mindful of their positions to dare breathe a word about Lady Mountrachet's origins. But Grandmama had felt no such compunction. She'd been only too happy to remember the Yorkshire girl whose pious parents, fallen on hard times, had leapt at the opportunity to pack her off to Blackhurst Manor, Cornwall, where she might serve as protégé for the glorious Georgiana Mountrachet. Mama paused at the door. One last thing, Rose, the most important thing of all.
Yes, Mama?
The girl must be kept out of father's way. A task that shouldn't be difficult. Rose could count on one hand the number of times she'd seen father during the past year. All the same, her mother's vehemence was intriguing.
Mama?
A slight pause that Rose noted with growing interest, then the reply that raised more questions than it answered. Your father is a busy man. An important man. He doesn't need to be reminded constantly of the stain on his family's good name. She inhaled quickly, and her voice dropped to a grey whisper. Believe me when I tell you, Rose, none in this house shall benefit should the girl be allowed near father. Adeline pressed gently at her fingertip and watched as the red bead of blood appeared. It was the third time she'd pricked her finger in as many minutes. Embroidery had always served to calm her nerves, but their fraying this day had been complete. She set the petty point aside. It was the conversation with Rose that had her rattled, and the distracted tea with Dr. Matthews. But beneath it all, of course, lay the arrival of Georgiana's girl. Though physically a mere scrap of a child, she had brought something with her. Something invisible, like the atmospheric shift that precedes a mighty storm. And that something threatened to bring to an end everything for which Adeline had strived. Indeed, it had already started its insidious work, for all day Adeline had been beset with memories of her own arrival at Blackhurst. Memories she'd worked hard to forget,
and to ensure that others did too. When she'd arrived in 1886, Adeline had been met by a house that seemed empty of inhabitants. And what a house it was, bigger than anything she'd ever set foot inside. She'd stood for 10 minutes at least, waiting for some direction, for someone to receive her, until finally a young man, wearing a formal suit and a haughty expression, had appeared in the hall. He'd stopped, surprised, then checked his pocket watch. "You're early," he said, in a tone that left Adeline in little doubt as to his opinion of those who arrived before their time. "We're not expecting you until tea." She stood silently, unsure what was expected of her. The man huffed. "If you wait here, I'll find someone to show you to your room." Adeline was aware of being troublesome.
"I could take a walk through the garden if you prefer," she said in a meek voice, more conscious than ever of her northern accent, grown thicker in this glorious, airy room of white marble. The man nodded curtly. "That would do well." A footman had whisked her trunks away, so Adeline was unencumbered as she went back down the grand stairs. She stood at the bottom, looking this way and that, trying to shake the uncomfortable sense that she had somehow failed before she'd even begun. Reverend Lambert had mentioned the Montrachet family's wealth and stature numerous times during his afternoon visits with Adeline and her parents. It was an honour for the entire diocese, he'd said earnestly and often, that one of their own had been selected to undertake such an important task. His Cornish counterpart had searched far and wide, under direct instruction from the lady of the house, in order to select the most suitable candidate, and it was up to Adeline to ensure that she was worthy of so great an honour, not to mention the generous fee that would be paid to her parents for their loss. And Adeline had been determined to succeed. All the way from Yorkshire, she'd given herself stern little lectures on topics like "The appearance of quality is akin to the fact," and "A lady is as a lady does." But inside the house, her faithless convictions had withered weakly away. A noise above drew her attention to the sky, where a family of black rooks was tracing an intricate pattern. One of the birds fell steeply in flight before following the others in the direction of a stand of tall trees in the distance. For want of another destination, Adeline set off after them, lecturing herself all the way about new beginnings and starting as one meant to go on. So involved was Adeline in her self-haranguing that she had little power of observation left with which to absorb the wondrous gardens of Blackhurst. Before she'd even made a start on her affirmations about rank and the aristocracy, she had cleared the dark coolness of the woods and was standing on the edge of a cliff, dry grasses rustling at her feet. Beyond the cliff, tossed out flat like a hank of velvet, was the deep blue sea. Adeline clutched hold of a nearby branch. She had never been one for heights, and her heart was racing. Something in the water directed her gaze back towards the cove. A young man and woman in a little boat, he seated while she stood rocking the boat from side to side. Her dress of white muslin was wet from the ankles to her waist and clung to her legs in a manner that made Adeline gasp. She felt that she should turn away, but she couldn't take her eyes from them. The young woman had red hair, such bright red hair, hanging loose and long, turning to wet tendrils at the end. The man had on a straw boater, a black box-shaped contraption strung around his neck. He was laughing, flicking water in the girl's direction. He started crawling towards her, reached out to grab at her legs. The boat rocked more violently, and just when Adeline thought he would touch her, the girl turned and dived in one long, fluid motion into the water. Nothing in Adeline's experience had prepared her for such behavior. What could have possessed the young woman to do such a thing? And where was she now? Adeline craned to see, scanned the glistening water until finally a figure in white became visible, gliding to the surface near the great black rock. The girl pulled herself from the sea,
dress glued to her body, water dripping, and without turning back, climbed the rock and disappeared up a hidden path in the steep hill, towards a little cottage on the cliff top. Fighting to control her shallow breaths, Adeline turned her attention to the young man, for surely he was equally shocked. He had also watched the girl disappear, and was now rowing the boat back to the cove. He pulled it out along the pebbles, picked up his shoes, and started up the steps. He had a limp, she noticed, and a cane. The man passed so close by Adeline, and yet he didn't see her. He was whistling to himself, a tune Adeline didn't know. A happy, jaunty tune, full of sunshine and salt. The antithesis of the gloomy Yorkshire she was so desperate to escape. This young man seemed twice as tall as the fellows back home, and twice as bright. Standing alone on the cliff top, she was aware suddenly of the heat and weight of her travelling suit. The water below looked so cool. The shameful thought was hers before she could control it. What might it feel like to dive beneath the surface and emerge, dripping wet, as the young woman, as Georgiana, had done? Later, many years later, when Linus's mother, the old witch, lay dying, she confessed her reason for selecting Adeline as Georgiana's protégé. "I was looking for the dullest little dormouse I could find, with piety a great plus, in the hopes that some of it would rub off on my daughter. I didn't suspect for a moment that my rare bird would take flight and the dormouse usurp her place. I suppose I should congratulate you. You won in the end, didn't you, Lady Montrachet?" And so she had. From humble beginnings, with hard work and determination, Adeline had risen in the world, higher than her parents could ever have imagined when they permitted her departure for an unknown village in Cornwall. And she had continued working hard, even after her marriage and assumption to the title Lady Montrachet. She'd run a tight ship, so that no matter the mud thrown, none would stick to her family, her grand home. And that was not about to change. Georgiana's girl was here now. That could not be helped. It was up to Adeline to ensure that life at Blackhurst Manor went on as ever. She just needed to free herself from the niggling fear that by Eliza's accommodation at Blackhurst, Rose would somehow be the loser. Adeline shook away the misgivings that continued to prick her skin and concentrated on regaining her composure. She had always been sensitive where Rose was concerned. That was what came of having a delicate child. Beside her, the dog, Askrig, whimpered. He, too, had been unsettled all day. Adeline reached down and stroked the knobbled head. "Shh," she said. "All will be well." She scratched his raised eyebrows. "I'll see to that." There was nothing to fear. For what risk could this interloper, this skinny girl with cropped hair and skin sallow from a life of poverty in London, possibly present to Adeline and her family? One needed only to glance at Eliza to see that she was no Georgiana, God be thanked. Why, perhaps these disquieting feelings weren't fear at all, but relief. Relief at having faced her worst fears and had them dissipate. For with Eliza's arrival came the additional comfort of knowing for certain that Georgiana was really gone, never to return. And in her place, a waif, with none of her mother's peculiar power for bending people to her will without so much as trying. The door opened, admitting a gust to tussle with the fire. "Dinner is served, ma'am." How Adeline despised Thomas, despised them all. For all their yes and no, ma'am, dinner is served, ma'am, she knew what they really thought of her, what they'd always thought of her. "The master?" Her coldest, most authoritative voice. "Lord Montrachet is on his way from the dark room, ma'am." The wretched dark room. Of course that's where he was. She'd heard his carriage arrive on the driveway whilst she was enduring tea with Dr. Matthews, had kept one ear trained on the entrance hall waiting for her husband's signature stride, heavy light, but nothing. She should have guessed that he'd gone straight to his infernal dark room. Thomas was still watching her, so Adeline screwed her composure to the sticking place. She'd sooner suffer at the hands of Lucifer himself than grant Thomas the satisfaction of noting marital disharmony. "Go," she said with a wave of her wrist, "and see to it personally that the master's boots are cleaned of the ghastly Scottish mud." Linus was already seated when Adeline arrived at the table. He'd started on his soup and didn't look up as she entered. He was too busy studying the black and white prints that were laid out over his end of the long table, moss and butterflies and bricks, the spoils of his recent trip. Seeing him, Adeline suffered a warm shot of air to the brain. What would others say if they knew that the Blackhurst dinner table was host to such behaviour? She glanced sideways at Thomas and the footman, each focused on the distant wall. But Adeline wasn't fooled. She knew that behind their glazed expressions their minds were busy, judging, noting, preparing to tell their counterparts in other houses about the slipping standards of Blackhurst Manor. Adeline sat stiffly in her place, waited as the footman placed her soup in front of her. She took a small mouthful and burned her tongue. Watched as Linus, head bowed, continued his inspection of the photographic prints. The little patch at the very crown of his head was thinning. It looked like a sparrow had been at work, laying the first scanty threads for a new nest. "The girl is here," he said without looking up. Adeline felt her skin prickle, the wretched girl. "She is." "You've seen her?" "Of course. She has been accommodated upstairs." Finally, he lifted his head, took a sip of his wine, then another. "And is she like..." "No." Adeline's voice was cold. "Nope, she is not." In her lap, her fists balled tight. Linus exhaled shortly, broke a piece of bread and began to eat it. He spoke with his mouth full, surely just to spite her. "Mansell said as much." If anyone was to blame for the girl's arrival, it was Henry Mansell. Linus may have sought Georgiana's return, but it was Mansell who'd kept the hope alive. The detective, with his thick moustache and fine pince-nez, had taken Linus's money and sent him frequent reports. Every night Adeline had prayed that Mansell would fail, that Georgiana would stay away, that Linus would learn to let her go. "Your trip went well?" said Adeline. No answer. His eyes were on the prints again. Adeline's pride prevented another sideways glance at Thomas. She composed her features in a mask of contented calm and attempted another spoonful of soup, cooler by now. Linus's rejection of Adeline was one thing. He'd begun his drift soon after their marriage, but his complete denial of Rose was something other. She was his child. His blood coursed through her veins, the blood of his noble family. How he could remain so detached, Adeline couldn't fathom. "Dr. Matthews has been again today," she said. "Another infection." Linus looked up, eyes drawn with the familiar veil of disinterest. Ate another mouthful of bread. "Nothing too serious, thank goodness," said Adeline, buoyed by his lifted gaze. "No need for grave concern." Linus swallowed his piece of bread. "I head for France tomorrow," he said blankly. "There's a gate at Notre Dame." His sentence faded away. Commitment to keeping Adeline informed of his movements only went so far. Adeline's left brow peaked slightly before she caught it and ironed it smooth. "Lovely," she said, winding her lips back into a tight smile, smothering the image, from nowhere, of Linus in the little boat, camera pointed at a figure dressed all in white.
Thank you.
Chapter 27. Tregenna, 1975. There it was, the black rock of William Martin's story. From the top of the cliff, Nell watched as white sea froth swirled about the base before rushing inside the cave and being sucked back out on the tide. It didn't take much to imagine the cove as the site of thrashing storms and sinking ships and midnight smuggling raids. Across the cliff top, a line of trees stood soldier-like, blocking Nell's view of the house at Blackhurst, her mother's house. She dug her hands deeper into the pockets of her coat. The wind was strong up here, and it took all her strength to maintain balance. Her neck was numb, her cheeks simultaneously warm with chafing and cool with the breeze. She turned to follow the path of flattened grass back from the cliff edge. The road didn't come this far, and the way was narrow. Nell went cautiously. Her knee was swollen and bruised after the rather impromptu entrance she'd made to the Blackhurst estate the previous day. She'd gone intending to deliver a letter, saying that she was an antiques dealer visiting from Australia, and requesting that she might come and see the house, at a time convenient to its owners. But as she'd stood by the tall metal gates, something had overcome her, a need every bit as strong as that to breathe. The next she knew, she'd abandoned all dignity and was clambering gracelessly up the gate, seeking footholds in the decorative metal curls. Ridiculous behavior for a woman half her age, but that was as it was. To stand so close to her family home, her own birthplace, and be denied as much as a glimpse was intolerable. It was only regrettable that Nell's physical dexterity had been no match for her tenacity. She'd been embarrassed and grateful in equal measure when Julia Bennett chanced upon her trespass attempt. Thankfully, the new owner of Blackhurst had accepted Nell's explanation and invited her to take a look. It had been such an odd feeling seeing inside the house. Strange, but not in the way she'd expected. Nell had been speechless with anticipation. She'd walked across the entrance hall, climbed the stairs, peered around doorways, telling herself over and over, "Your mother sat here. Your mother walked here. Your mother loved here." And she had waited for the enormity to hit her, for some wave of knowing to launch itself from the house's walls and crash over her, for some deep part of herself to recognize that she was home. But no such knowingness had come. A foolish expectation, of course, and not like Nell at all. But there it was. Even the most pragmatic person fell victim at times to a longing for something other. At least she could now add texture to the memories she was trying to rebuild. Imagined conversations would take place in real rooms. In the long shimmery grass, Nell spied a stick just the right length. There was something immeasurably pleasant in walking with such a stick. It added a sense of industry to a person's journey. Not to mention it would take some pressure off her swollen knee. She reached to pick it up and continued carefully down the slope, past the tall stone wall. There was a sign on the front gate, just above that which threatened trespassers. "For sale," it read, and then a phone number. This, then, was the cottage belonging to the Blackhurst estate, the one Julia Bennett had mentioned the day before, and that William Martin had wished burned to the ground, that had stood witness to things that weren't right, whatever they might be. Nell leaned against the gate. There didn't look to be much threatening about it. The garden was overgrown, and the approaching dusk spilled into every corner, settled for the night in cool, dim pockets. A narrow path led towards the cottage before scurrying left at the front door and continuing its windy way through the garden. By the far wall stood a lonely statue plastered with green lichen. A small naked boy in the middle of a garden bed, wide eyes turned eternal on the cottage. No, not a garden bed. The boy stood in a fish pond. The correction came swiftly and certainly, surprising Nell so that she held tighter to the locked gate. How did she know? Then before her eyes, the garden changed. Weeds and brambles, decades in the growing, receded. Leaves lifted from the ground, revealing paths and flower beds, and a garden seat. Light was permitted entry once more, tossed dappled across the surface of the pond. And then she was in two places at once, a 65-year-old woman with a sore knee, clinging to a rusty gate, and a little girl, long hair plaited down her back, sitting on a tuft of soft, cool grass, toes dangling in the pond. The plump fish bobbed to the surface again, golden belly shining, and the little girl laughed as he opened his mouth and nibbled her big toe. She loved the pond, had wanted one at home, but Mama had been fearful that she'd fall in and drown. Mama was often fearful, especially where the little girl was concerned. If Mama knew where they were today, she'd be very cross. But Mama didn't know. She was having one of her bad days, was lying in the dark of her boudoir with a damp flannel on her forehead. A noise, and the little girl looked up. The lady and Papa had come back outside. They stood for a moment, and Papa said something to the lady, something the little girl couldn't hear. He touched her arm, and the lady started walking slowly forwards. She was watching the little girl in a strange way, a way that reminded her of the boy statue who stood by the pond all day, never so much as blinking. The lady smiled, a magical smile, and the little girl pulled her feet from the pond and waited, waited, wondering what the lady would say. A rook flew close overhead, and with it time was restored. The brambles and creepers reformed, leaves dropped, and the garden was once more a damp, moist place at the mercy of the dusk. The boy statue green with age, just as he should be. Nell was aware of an ache in her knuckles. She loosened her grip on the gate and watched the rook, broad wings beating the air as he soared towards the top of the Blackhurst trees. In the west, a flock of clouds had been lit from behind and glowed pink in the darkening sky. Nell glanced dazedly at the cottage garden. The little girl was gone. Or was she? As Nell dug the stick in before her and started back towards the village, a peculiar sense of duality, not unwelcome, followed her all the way. Chapter 28, Blackhurst Manor, 1900. Next morning, as pale, wintry light rippled the glass of the nursery windows, Rose smoothed the ends of her long, dark hair. Mrs. Hopkins had brushed it until it shone, just the way Rose liked, and it sat perfectly against the lace of her very finest dress, the one that Mama had sent for from Paris. Rose was feeling tired and a little tetchy, but that was her wont. Little girls with weak constitutions weren't expected to be happy all the time, and Rose had no intention of performing against type. If she were honest, she rather liked having people walk on eggshells around her. It made her feel a little less miserable when others were similarly stifled. Besides, Rose had good reason for weariness today. She had lain awake all night, tossing and turning like the princess with her pea, only it hadn't been a lump in the mattress that had kept her awake, rather Mama's astonishing news. After Mama had left the bedroom, Rose had fallen to pondering the precise nature of the stain on her family's good name, exactly what sort of drama had erupted after her Aunt Georgiana's flight from home and family. All night she had wondered about her wicked aunt, and the thoughts had not evaporated with the dawn. During breakfast, and later while Mrs. Hopkins dressed her, even now as she waited in the nursery, her mind was so engaged. She was watching the firelight flickering against the pale hearth bricks, wondering whether the dusky orange shadows resembled the door to hell through which her aunt must surely have passed, when suddenly, footsteps in the hallway! Rose jumped a little in her seat, smoothed the lambswool blanket across her knees, and quickly arranged her face along the lines of placid perfection she'd learned from Mama. Cherished the little thrill that worked its way down her spine. Oh, what an important task it was. The assignment of a protege. Her very own wayward orphan to remake in her own image. Rose had never had a friend before, nor been allowed a pet of any kind. Mama had grave concerns about rabies. And despite Mama's words of caution, she harbored great hopes of this cousin of hers. She would be turned into a lady, would become a companion for Rose, someone to mop Rose's brow when she was ill, stroke her hand when she was peevish, brush her hair when she was bothered. And she would be so grateful for Rose's instruction, so happy to have been granted insight into the ways of ladies, that she would do exactly as Rose ordered. She would be the perfect friend, one who never argued, never behaved tiresomely, never so much as ventured a disagreeable opinion. The door opened, the fire sputtered crossly at the disturbance, and Mama strode into the room, blue skirt swishing. There was an agitation to Mama's manner today that piqued Rose's interest, something in the set of her chin that suggested her misgivings about the project were greater and more varied than she had revealed. "Good morning, Rose," she said rather curtly.
"Good morning, Mama."
"Allow me to present your cousin." The slightest pause. "Eliza." And then, from somewhere behind Mama's skirts, was thrust forth the skinny sapling Rose had glimpsed from the window the day before. Rose couldn't help it. She drew back a little into the safe arms of her chair. Her gaze slid from top to bottom, taking in the child's short, shaggy hair, the ghastly attire, breeches, her knobbly knees and scuffed boots. The cousin said nothing, merely stared in a wide-eyed way Rose found exceptionally rude. Mama was right. This girl, for surely she wasn't expected to think of her as a cousin, had been deprived of even the most basic education on manners. Rose recaptured her flagging composure.
"How do you do?"
Her tone was a little weak, but a nod from Mama assured her that she had performed well. She awaited a return greeting, but none was forthcoming. Rose glanced at Mama, who indicated that she should push on regardless.
"And tell me, Cousin Eliza," she tried again, "are you enjoying your time here with us?"
Eliza blinked at her as one might a curious foreign animal in the London Zoo, then nodded. Another set of footsteps in the hall, and Rose was granted brief respite from the challenge of summoning up further pleasantries to converse with this strange, silent cousin.
"I'm sorry to interrupt you, my lady," came Mrs. Hopkins's voice from the door, "only Dr. Matthews is downstairs in the morning room. He says he's brought the new tincture you were asking after."
"Have him leave it for me, Mrs. Hopkins. I have other business to attend to at present."
"Of course, my lady, and I suggested as much to Dr. Matthews, but he was most definite about giving it to you himself."
Mama's eyelashes performed the slightest of flutters, so subtle that only one whose life work had involved observation of her moods would have noticed.
"Thank you, Mrs. Hopkins," she said grimly. "Advise Dr. Matthews that I will be down directly."
As Mrs. Hopkins's footsteps disappeared down the hallway, Mama turned to the cousin and said in a clear, authoritative voice,
"You will sit silently on the rug and listen carefully as Rose instructs you. Do not move. Do not speak. Do not touch a thing."
"But Mama..." Rose had not expected to be left alone so soon.
"Perhaps you will begin your lessons by giving your cousin some guidance as to proper dress."
"Yes, Mama." And then the billowing blue skirts were receding again. The door was closed, and the room's fire ceased spitting. Rose met the cousin's gaze. They were alone together, and the work would begin.
"Put that down! Put it down at once!"
Things were not going at all as Rose had imagined.
The girl would not listen, would not obey, did not fall into line even when Rose raised the threat of Mama's wrath. For 5 whole minutes now, Eliza had been wandering around the nursery, picking things up, inspecting them, putting them down again. No doubt, leaving sticky fingerprints everywhere. At this moment, she was shaking the kaleidoscope that some great aunt or another had sent for Rose's birthday one year.
"That's precious," Rose said sourly. "I insist that you leave it. You're not even doing it right."
Too late, Rose realized she had said the wrong thing. Now the cousin was coming towards her, holding out the kaleidoscope. Coming so close, Rose could glimpse the dirt beneath her fingernails, the dreaded dirt that Mama promised would make her ill. Rose was horrified. She shrank back against her chair, head spinning.
"No," she managed to say. "Shoo! Get away!"
Eliza stopped at the arm of the chair, seemed about to perch herself right there on the velvet.
"Get away," I said.
Rose flapped a pale, weak hand.
"Did it not understand the Queen's English? You mustn't sit right by me."
"Why not?"
"So it did have words. You've been outside. You're not clean. I could catch something."
Rose collapsed back against the cushion.
"I'm awfully dizzy now, and it's all your fault."
"It's not my fault," said Eliza plainly, not even the tiniest note of proper supplication. "I'm dizzy too. It's because this room's as hot as a furnace."
"She dizzy too?"
Rose was speechless. Dizziness was her own special weapon to deploy. And what was the cousin doing now? She was on her feet again, moving towards the nursery window. Rose watched, eyes wide with fear. Surely she didn't intend to...
"I'll just get this open."
Eliza jiggled the first lock loose. "Then we'll be right."
"No!"
Rose felt terror surge within her.
"No!"
"You'll feel much better."
"But it's winter. It's come over all dark and cloudy outside. I might catch a chill."
Eliza shrugged. "You might not." Rose was so shocked by the girl's cheek that indignation outweighed fear. She adopted Mama's voice.
"I demand that you stop."
Eliza wrinkled her nose, seemed to be digesting this instruction. As Rose held her breath, the cousin's hands dropped from the window lock. She shrugged again, but the gesture was somehow less impertinent this time. As she wandered back towards the center of the room, Rose thought she detected a pleasing despondence in the set of Eliza's shoulders. Finally, the girl stopped in the center of the rug and pointed at the cylinder in Rose's lap.
"Can you show me how it works? The telescope. I couldn't see through it."
Rose exhaled, weary, relieved and increasingly confused by this strange creature. Really, to have turned her attention back to the silly trinket again, just like that. Still, the cousin had been obedient, and surely that deserved some small encouragement.
"First of all," she said primly, "it's not a telescope at all. It's a kaleidoscope. You're not supposed to see through it. You look inside, and the pattern changes."
She held it up and performed the action before laying the toy on the floor and rolling it towards her cousin. Eliza picked it up and put it to her eye, turned the end. As the pieces of colored glass rattled this way and that, her mouth spread into a wide smile, which broadened until she was laughing. Rose blinked with surprise. She hadn't heard much laughter before, only the servants occasionally when they thought she wasn't near. The sound was lovely, a happy, light, girlish sound, quite at odds with her cousin's appearance.
"Why do you wear those clothes?" said Rose.
Eliza continued to peer through the kaleidoscope. "Because they're mine," she said eventually. "They belong to me."
"They look as if they belong to a boy."
"Once upon a time they did. Now they're mine." This was a surprise. Things were becoming more curious with each passing minute.
"Which boy?"
There came no answer, just the jiggling of the kaleidoscope.
"I said, which boy?"
A little louder this time. Slowly, Eliza lowered the toy.
"It's very bad manners to ignore people, you know."
"I'm not ignoring you," said Eliza.
"Then why don't you answer?"
Another shrug.
"It's rude to lift your shoulders like that. When someone speaks to you, you must provide them with an answer. Now, tell me, why were you ignoring my question?"
Eliza looked up and stared at her. As Rose watched, something seemed to change in her cousin's face. A light that hadn't been there before seemed now to glow behind her eyes. "I didn't speak because I didn't want her to know where I was."
"Her who?"
Carefully, slowly, Eliza came a little closer. "The other cousin."
"What other cousin?"
Really, the girl spoke no sense. Rose was beginning to think she truly was simple.
"I don't know what you're talking about," she said. "There is no other cousin."
"She's a secret. They keep her locked upstairs."
"You're making it up. Why would anyone keep her a secret?"
"They kept me a secret, didn't they?"
"They didn't keep you locked upstairs."
"That's because I wasn't dangerous." Eliza tiptoed to the nursery door, prized it open a crack, and peered outside. She gasped.
"What?"
said Rose.
"Shh!"
Eliza held a finger to her lips. "We can't let her know we're in here."
"Why?"
Rose's eyes were wide. Eliza tiptoed back to the edge of Rose's chair. The flickering firelight in the darkening room gave her face an eerie glow.
"Our other cousin," she said, "is insane." "Mad?"
"As a hatter." Eliza lowered her voice so that Rose had to lean close to hear. "She's been locked in the attic since she was small, but someone's let her out."
"Who?"
"One of the ghosts. The ghost of an old woman, a very fat old woman."
"Grandmama,"
whispered Rose.
"Shh," said Eliza. "Listen. Footsteps."
Rose could feel her poor, feeble heart leaping like a frog in her chest. Eliza jumped onto the arm of Rose's chair.
"She's coming!"
The door opened and Rose screamed. Eliza grinned and Mama gasped.
"What are you doing up there, wicked girl?"
she hissed, gaze flitting from Eliza to Rose.
"Young ladies do not sit astride the furniture. You were told not to move."
Her breathing was loud.
"Are you harmed, my Rose?"
Rose shook her head.
"No, Mama."
For just an instant, Mama seemed at a rare loss. Rose almost feared that she might cry. Then she seized Eliza by the upper arm and marched her towards the door.
"Wicked girl! You'll have no supper tonight."
A familiar steel had returned to her voice.
"And no supper any night thereafter. Not until you learn to do as you are told. I am mistress of this house, and you will obey me."
The door closed, and Rose sat alone once more, wondering at this peculiar turn of events. The thrill of Eliza's story, the curious, enjoyable fear that had stalked up her spine, the terrible, wonderful spectre of the mad other cousin. But it was the crack that had appeared in Mama's usually cast-iron composure that intrigued Rose most of all. For in that moment, the stable borders of Rose's world had seemed to shift. All was not as it had been. And that knowledge made Rose's heart thump, strongly now, with unexpected, unexplained, unadulterated joy. Chapter 29. The Blackhurst Hotel. 2005. The colours were different here. Cassandra had never realised how sharp the Australian glare was until she met the gentle Cornish light. She wondered how she'd go about replicating it in watercolours. Surprised herself for having wondered. She took a bite of buttery toast and chewed thoughtfully. Looked at the line of trees that stood on the cliff edge. Closing one eye, she lifted her index finger to trace along their tops. A shadow fell across her table, and there was a voice right beside her. "Cassandra? Cassandra Ryan?" A woman in her early 60s was standing by the table, silver blonde and shapely, with eye makeup whose application had left no corner of the shadow compact unexplored. "I'm Julia Bennett. I own the Blackhurst Hotel." Cassandra wiped a buttery finger on her napkin and shook hands. "Nice to meet you." Julia indicated the vacant chair. "Mind if I..." "Of course not. Please." Julia sat down, and Cassandra waited uncertainly, wondering whether this was part of the personalized service threatened in the brochure. "I hope you're enjoying your stay with us. It's a lovely spot." Julia looked at her and smiled so that dimples appeared in each cheek. "You know, I can see your grandmother in you, but I bet you hear that all the time." Behind Cassandra's polite smile, a flock of questions resisted shepherding. How did this stranger know who she was? How did she know Nell? How had she put the two of them together? Julia laughed and leaned forward, conspiratorially. "A little birdie told me the Australian girl who'd inherited the cottage was in town. Tregenna is a small place. You sneeze on the Sharpstone Cliff, and the fellows in the harbour know all about it." Cassandra realised who the bird in question was. Robin Jameson. "She was here yesterday, trying to enlist me for the festival committee," said Julia. "Couldn't resist imparting the local comings and goings while she was at it. I put two and two together and connected you with the lady who came to call some 30 years ago. Saved my skin by taking the cottage off my hands. I always wondered when your grandmother would return. Kept an eye out for her for some time. I liked her. She was a straight shooter, wasn't she?" The description was so accurate that Cassandra couldn't help wondering what Nell had said or done to earn it. "You know, the first time I met your grandmother, she was hanging from a rather thick wisteria near the front entrance." "Really?" Cassandra's eyes widened. "She'd scaled the front wall and was having difficulty getting down on the other side. Lucky for her, I'd just had an argument with my husband Richard, number 97, for the day, and I was stalking around the grounds trying to cool down. I hate to think how long she'd have been hanging there otherwise." "She was trying to see the house?" Julia nodded. "Said she was an antiques dealer, interested in Victoriana, and wondered if she could take a peek inside." Cassandra felt a fierce flame of affection for Nell as she imagined her scaling walls and telling half-truths, refusing to take no for an answer. "I told her she was welcome to come in just as soon as she'd finished swinging from my creepers." Julia laughed. "The house was in pretty poor condition. It had been roundly neglected for decades by then, and Rick and I had dismantled things to the point that they looked far worse.